that year with five. Three of them were made in four appearances in mid-June, each with two men on base. And he hit three-run pinch-hit homers in both games of the June 17th doubleheader against the A's at Fenway. Do you recall that game?
I don't recall the games. I remember he had an awful streak of hitting home runs as a pinch hitter. But I, you know, I never recall, so I can't recall specific things.
Okay. What do you think of him as a manager?
I think he was a great hitter. I think Joe's, no matter what the records say, I think Joe is one of the toughest right-hand hitters I've ever seen up at the plate. I'd just as soon have him up at the plate as anybody. He was a very shrewd hitter and knew how to decoy catches into getting the pitch he wanted. I'd see Joe take batting practice lots of times and in batting practice hit every ball to right field. The other club saying, oh, he's trying to hit behind the running all the time now. Now all of a sudden he's drooped over the plate when that game starts and he bends back and gets that ball up and here in his out in Lansdowne Street. So he was a cutie pie. He was a very shrewd. A lot of times, I drove in the winning run for Houston five times out of those 22 games in 42. And most every pitch that I hit, Cronin told me before I went to the plate what you're going to have to hit. He'd say, this guy is going to curb you, Johnny Murphy, if you just wait for the one pitch and you're going to get it. And never once was he wrong. It's a judgment on pitching. In other words, a good hitter is a student of pitching. He's a student of anything else. And he was a great, no question, he was a great clutch hitter. One of the best right-handed hitters I've ever seen. I don't know, I don't mean to malign the man. He's a fine gentleman. He was not what I would consider one of the best handlers of pitches that I've ever seen. I don't think he understood the rotation of pitches. You've got to remember now, when he broke in as a manager, he had Clyde Mylan and two or three old-timers coaching for him in Washington. He was a player, and he had old heads running his ball club. Then when he came over here as a manager early in his career, he had people like Wahlberg and Grove that were experienced pitchers. And they pitched about when they wanted to and how they wanted to. But when it came to running a young staff like we had, he was no Bill Burwell. He didn't, to me, understand the matter of starting a rotation and staying with it, whoever you played with or against. And this is why we ended up beating the top flighters and getting the hell beat out of us with the lowers instead of fattening up on them. But he had very fine ideas offensively. He was a good man to play for, excellent man to play for. He'd let you hit and let you go on your own, and then fine. But I'd say probably his flaw was the handling of pitches.
How would you rate him vis-a-vis other managers you had? I remember you telling me once that your favorite was Dykes.
Oh, yeah, Dykes would be number one, Burwell number two, probably Harry Leibold number three, Cronin number four, and Fitzsimmons number five, something like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't rate him as one of the better men. I mean, outstanding people.
Okay.
Of course, we must say that the man had tremendous success. He was not only manager, he was vice president of the Boston Club, president of the American League. That's a hell of a lot better than I've ever aspired to. You know, I take my hat off to his accomplishments, but you're asking me a question of quality, and I have to give you an evaluation as a manager. That would be it.
Okay. Also, in 1943, there was a practice blackout that caused a 65-minute delay in the game in Philadelphia. Do you have any recollections of that?
We had it in Boston. We were playing Chicago, and Buck Ross was the pitcher. And I was the hitter, and he got me two strikes and a ball in the blackout game. And we're down in the tunnels waiting for this thing to be off. And Ross says to me, well, he says, you've got 35 minutes to figure out what my next pitch is going to be. But I remember that it was in Boston. We happened to be in Boston when that took place.
Okay. Tony, let's talk about wartime travel and eating conditions. Very few of the ballplayers I've interviewed went into it at great length, George Cates being a notable exception. Let's talk about food on the trains. I understand that during the war, servicemen got fed first, and oftentimes the players got either very little to eat or else they ate very late.
There were priorities, obviously, that the war, that the people in the war effort have got to get the first shot. And a lot of times with the rationing of meat and so forth, by the time you got ready to eat, they wouldn't have many of the items on the menu. And many times, you just didn't get around to eating. Let's say you're on the New York to Philadelphia run. By the time it came time for you to sit down, you're pulling into North Philly. So now you're going to get out and get a sandwich or something. And it was a catch-as-catch-can. Now, a lot of times I stood up from New York to Philadelphia. The trains were so crowded, and you just accepted that.
Do you think that affected the performances of the ball players?
No, I don't believe so. Not very much.
Okay. What about the eating in hotels?
Well, the hotel food was bad then too, of course.
Meatless days.
A lot of meatless days, a lot of spaghetti days, and a lot of us would ignore the fact that you could eat in a hotel and go out and eat on your own in order to have some selection. You might want to get a chicken or something. So I think the food situation was a great deal different than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, again, I was reading about the other day about a big upset they had in one of the clubhouses about these big feeds that they have after the ball game. I don't like the idea of buying food for the ball player and putting it out in the clubhouse. No matter what you do with the ball player, you're not going to please them. If you have roast beef, you want ham. So let him, give them the money and say, get out and eat on your own. And then you pick it, you make the choice. I think the club gets himself in a tough position when they do this. Because I realize that with the way the thing is done now in the night ball, it's all, almost necessary. There aren't restaurants open by the time you want to eat at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see why they're catering in the clubhouses. In the wartime, the food, like everything else, was not quite up to snuff.
Okay, did you have any problem as far as lack of sleeping cars on short trips?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the sleeping car situation was, again, it was a time when there weren't enough cars to go around, and of course the servicemen had to have them. So there were a lot of upper berth jobs, and a lot of times that you'd ride day coach, and then the schedule, the train priorities of the freight and armaments and so forth, it might take you an extra half day to come from St. Louis to Boston rather than the usual.
Do you have any anecdotes about wartime traveler eating restrictions other than the one you told me about the blackout?
No, I can't think offhand.
Gas rationing was in effect. Did you have any trouble getting coupons?
Yes, I used to bum to the ballpark a lot of times when I was in Boston because we lived in Lexington. It was easier to get out on the road than to try to scramble for the gas.
Mm-hmm.
And in Philadelphia, I didn't have a car, but we used to go back and forth, three or four of us, pool our resources. Transportation was always tough during this period.
Do you remember any situations on trips up the East Coast, especially, say, New York to Boston, where the train passed near the ocean, where the curtains had to be drawn and the windows had just been blacked out? This is early in the war, and they were worried about the U-boat damage.
I can't remember. I don't recall. I imagine the curtains were down, but I really don't recall that. I just didn't. It doesn't run through my mind.
Okay. In 1943, all major league clubs began spring training, or holding spring training north of the Mason-Dixon line, and the Red Sox trained at Tufts University in Medford. Any interesting stories surrounding that?
No, it was a difficult time, of course. Training indoors because the weather up here was so bad. I don't think we got out over a day or two. And then we went down, the Yankees were training in Asbury Park, if I remember correctly, and we went down that way and played a few games before the season started. I think we played in Baltimore. I think it does prove that a lot of the spring training is extra, that you don't need quite so much spring training as...
So you felt that you and the other members of the Red Sox were in pretty good shape?
Well, I think so. I think that most of our complaints were because of the dead ball rather than... See, they changed to that Balata ball.
Balata ball.
And you couldn't hit the ball if you wound up from Port Arthur. You couldn't hit the ball 15 feet, you know. So it got you down at the start of that season. It was really tough. A lot of 1-0, 2-1. You're always playing infield. And every chance is life and death. it was a different kind of baseball.
Yeah.
With that ball.
Okay, what were the circumstances of your being waived to the Phillies on April 13, 1944? It was about 5 days before the season began.
Well, I hadn't played. I'd had a bad year in Boston in 43, and I think that that plus the fact that I was winning in the draft, militated to say this would be a good time to make a move. And also Pennock, who had taken over the Philadelphia club, had been in the Boston organization, and I think they were trying to pass a few players to him if they could. I went, Peacock went, and Tabor finally went.
Right, I was going to ask you, Andy Carl, Skeeter Newsom,
yeah,
and Oscar Judd went up there.
Yeah, a lot of the people went from Boston to Philadelphia, and that I think Pennock must have had quite a bit to do with it.
In other words, he and Eddie Collins had a pipeline going.
Yeah, I think pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Well, you took the majority of spring training in Baltimore in 44. That's where the Red Sox trained in 44. Do you have any stories about that?
No, it was a terrible spring training. I know that. We stayed in a hotel downtown, and it was just not much of a spring training atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Baltimore would be the best place in the world to bring a club for spring training. But they were very friendly with the Dunn family at the time, and Tommy Thomas was over there, who was a great friend of Cronin's, and a lot of things have done on friendship, you know.
Sure. Any stories about the 44 Phillies? It wasn't a very good ball club. You finished 8th, 61-92, 43 and a half games behind the leaders.
I don't know how far we were off of fourth place. It was a very strange ball club. We suffered from lack of pitching too, and we had no shortstop. We played off. See, everybody that came down the pike got a shot at shortstop. You could drive a stake out there and stop more balls than we were stopping. So we had an awful time. We had enough power to make runs. We made some runs, but we just couldn't hold them. That's all. Triplett had a pretty good year. I had a pretty good year. Wardell. Buster Adams
would come over from the Cardinals,
yeah,
and trade for Lebwiler.
Yeah, he played center field good.
Mm-hmm.
So we made some runs, but we just had bad pitching. We had real bad pitching and a bad shortstop. I don't know how many double plays we made, but we couldn't have made too many.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of veterans on that pitching staff. I'd like to ask you about them. One was Bill Lee, who had several good years with the Cubs and was kind of on the way down.
Yes, he was. He's a fine guy, a perfect gentleman, knew how to pitch, and he always gave you a good ball game. His curveball was starting to hang a little bit at that time, but he still had enough savvy that he was a tough man to beat. He pitched well for it. We had some of the characters of the game, of course, people like Hubie Doll, Dick Barrett.
He was the other one I was going to ask you. A great pitcher in the Coast League for years. What was he like?
This is one of the all-time characters of baseball.
Oh, really?
His name was Oliver, Dick Oliver. He came from Philadelphia. And he had played around Philadelphia under an assumed name. And he signed with the Athletics, I believe.
Well, Oliver was the assumed name.
Well, it might have, well, whatever it was. He was always one or the other. And he told me he pitched a game against Satchel Paige when he was a kid in Philadelphia for one of those semi-pro teams that was good there. They went 9 innings in 55 minutes. The two of them got together before the game and said, let's see how fast you can pitch a ball game. So they had the catcher sit down, both the Satch's guy and his guy. They just sat in the crouch and they just got the ball and pitched as fast as they could. And they got the thing in 9 innings and 55 minutes. He was one of the all-time characters.
Really?
He always carried a pint of VO in his suit coat pocket.
Yeah.
He was very much in love with VO. He thought this was the greatest thing in the world. So you'd be on the train going in to have breakfast in the morning, and you'd stop. Dick, you want to have? Yeah, let's go. We'll have breakfast. We get out in the vestibule, and he'd say, you know that arm of mine, that shoulder's killing me. I think I got to do something for it. So he'd take the pint out, get it up, and he'd lean over so his shoulder would be down, and he'd pour that whiskey down. He'd say, yeah, it's running right down into that shoulder, just a gulp. Great. It'd be off and running. And he was something else. We played over in Cincinnati one day, a doubleheader, and it was hotter than hell. Cincinnati is very warm. And he got knocked out in the third inning in the first game. He went out into the clubhouse. They had a clubhouse in left field in Crosley Field. It was an old house, really. Just an old beat-up house that they had divided up into a clubhouse. So we go in between games, and there he's been drinking beer, laying on the table. He's got a silk underwear on and black socks. We get into the second game, and Fitz is looking for him. We run into trouble, and Freddie Fitzsimmons says, "Where the hell is Barrett?" So they had to run in the clubhouse, and he pulled his uniform on over his silk underwear with the black socks and put the uniform on and ran out into the bullpen. And he threw about three pitches before Fitz had him in there. And here he is walking to the mound looking like a real semi-pro, you know, black socks on. And you can see he's got no jockstrap. He just looks the most disheveled-looking person you ever saw. He did some of the funniest things. In the Coast League when I was there in 46 or 47, he was pitching for Seattle. He pitched for Portland and Seattle during that time. And there was a guy named Bill Schuster that was playing for L.A., and Bill was
playing
for
the Cubs. He was another cut-up, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. And they were great buddies. They played together, and they were great funsters. So Bill Schuster says to Dick, "Sometime if we're playing, and I'm the third out, there's two men out and I come up, if I ever hit a routine ground ball, it's going to be an easy chance, instead of running to first base, I'm going to run right at the mound. You open your legs, and I'll dive right through." So they're playing in L.A., and they got 18,000-20,000 people in the place. They threw like the devil in. And the play comes up, and he dives through Dick's legs. I forget who's managing L.A. at the time. Big, tall guy, first baseman. Kelly. Bill Kelly. He finds Schuster and the other guy find Dick up, and there was a big uproar about it. That sort of thing was down his alley.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God, he was funny.
Hey, what about, you also had Al Gerhauser on the staff.
Gerhauser was on the staff, yeah. He didn't have real good stuff. He just had ordinary stuff.
Mm-hmm. Andy Carl had come over from the Red Sox. He was a reliever. I understand he had ulcers. Only ate crackers and milk all the time.
Yeah, he always looked pale and worn. I roomed with him in Philadelphia for a short period of time. He never was in good health, really. He had a good knuckleball and knew how to throw it. We had Vern Kennedy, too, and Raffensperger.
Yeah, Charlie Shands.
Charlie Shands. Yeah.
They were the main pitchers. What about Raffensperger?
He was a good cutie pitcher. He knew how to pitch, and he'd just as soon pitch with a short left field fences. No, nothing bothered him. He was a good pitcher.
Do you wish to comment on any of the Phillies ballplayers? I'll mention some here. You've talked about Buster Adams, Jimmy Wasdell, there was Ron Northey, who I know had a gun in right field.
Oh, yeah, Ron could throw, he could hit the ball, too. He was a funny guy. He came from Frackville, Pennsylvania. He's all talking about Frackville. And Wasdell was one of the characters of all time, you know. This guy should have been a real great ball player. He was beamed in the Southern League by Dick Lanahan, who was a hard-throwing left-hander, and he had a steel plate in his head. So he was a little bit crazy. Like, no, I don't mean by that he should be in an asylum, but he did some very unusual things. He used to like to catch foul balls. He said, "I'm going to leave the league and catching foul balls." So he'd play on the line in left field, he'd catch all those foul balls, and Adams would be running down balls in that slot where the legs right down under your knees, but he loved to catch foul balls. He did some crazy things. He'd played first base at Brooklyn, you know, and Fitz had played over there, and he'd won a couple of games for Fitz, and that year they won the pennant, and Fitz had a great liking for him. He had played in Washington. He played first base in Washington until he said one day that he always wanted to make that first and second bunt situation thing as a first baseman when you charge in. He said, "I'm going to throw the ball to the second baseman covering like a football center." So he said, "I came in and men on first and second, nobody out in Washington." And he said, "I charged the ball, got the ball and threw it, but the trouble was the second baseman wasn't there, and the ball went down in the right field corner," and he said, "I was in Minneapolis the next day." But that sort of, he did some of the darndest things, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was a real character.
the guys who were the regular infielders, well, they were kind of nondescript. Second base was a guy named Moon Mullen.
Oh, we had everybody playing second base.
Shortstop was Ray Hamrick, and third was Glenn Stewart, and I know it was a revolving door.
Oh, and then we had some guy named Mott came by.
Bitsy Mott.
Itsy Bitsy Mott. Everybody who walked in.
And you had a guy who had been seriously hurt in the war. I think he was 4S by that time, Ted Cieslak.
We had Cieslak at third for a while, but he was mentally disturbed. They finally sent him back to Atlanta. He was driving Fitz crazy.
So really, it was a ragtag group of players for the most part?
Oh, boy. This was something. We had Charlie Letches, too, for a while at second base.
Yeah.
I ever tell you about the junk man Heine Hetzel from up in Reading?
Yeah, well, he came from York.
I've heard of
Heine Hetzel. I bet he pulped room with him for a while and said he loved to eat aspirin.
Oh, he sure did.
Tell me about Hetzel.
I think it's Hetzel. I don't know. H-E-T.
No,
is it Hetzel?
No,
well, it's not anyway. We lost a doubleheader one day in Philadelphia. It's about the middle of the summer. And Freddie Fitzsimmons and Merv Shea was his coach. And Johnny Peacock and I used to always ride back to the hotel, 2601 Parkway, in Fitz's car. And after Fitz got beat, this is nobody to toy with. He was a real competitor, and he was a raver and a screamer. So we're riding back in the car, and Peacock and I are sitting in the back seat keeping our mouth shut, and Fitz is going up and down one side of the car or the other. And Peacock is from North Carolina, and he says, "Oh, for Christ's sake, Fitz, what the hell? It's all over with now. When we get back to the hotel, come on up the room and let's have a drink with Tommy and I." Fitz says, "I thought I told you guys you're not supposed to be drinking nothing but beer." He says, "Oh, well, you know we're going to have something up there, so you and Merv come up and let's have a drink and forget things." So we go up the room and we have a couple of drinks, and Fitz is still raving. "You know," he says, "this is the first time I haven't been on a first division club in my life." He says, "I broke in Indianapolis on the first division club, and I've never finished out of the money with the Giants of Brooklyn." And he said, "If we had a shortstop, we'd finish in the money here, too." Have another drink, Fitz. So he said, "Boy, what a manager that Donnie Bush was at Indianapolis." So Peacock is feeling pretty good by now, and he says, "Well, listen, Fitz. Bush is such a good friend of yours. He owns the Indianapolis club now. If he's such a hell of a guy, call him up and maybe he'll get a shortstop for you." Jesus, Fitz says, "That's a great idea." Goes to the phone on the wall and he calls Bush and he gets him, and we're listening. Says, "Hi, Tony. Yeah, we got a pretty good club, but we don't have a shortstop. And if we had a shortstop, we could win, and that's why I'm calling you." "Yeah? Wait a minute. Let me get a pencil." "Oh, is that right? Yes, yes." He's writing down. "Great. Geez, I really appreciate this, Tony." Hangs the phone back up on the hook and he says, "Boys, we're in." He said, "Tony's got a shortstop for us." "Well, who is he?" "His name is Heine Hetzel." "Well, where is he?" "He's in jail in York. He beat up his wife or something and he's in the jailhouse up in York. And Indianapolis owns him. He's a suspended player, and if we can get him down here, if we can get Carpenter to go up there and spring him out of the jail, Tony will sell him to us." So, sure enough, they go up on Monday, and they spring this guy out of jail, and we've got an off day. Tuesday, we have a clubhouse meeting. Fitz says, "Boys, I got great news for you. We're going to finish the money. We just got a shortstop who can do the job for us." Now, he's a little bit eccentric, and he's been in a jail for a little while, and it'd be nice if you'd be really good to him. Don't, whatever he wants, be nice to him. In he comes, and he's pale, he's the color of chalk, little bit of a guy, you stand sideways, you mark him as, and so he starts working out with us. He's been in jail for a long time, so he hadn't played much, but pretty soon, after a couple of days, he goes over the hole, and he's throwing that ball 2 or 3 feet off the ground with good stuff to first base, and he can get the ball. He's not going to hit the ball out of the milk bottle, but he can feel, no question. So Fitz says, "Well, it's too tough. These Philadelphia fans are too tough. We'll break them in on the road to give them confidence." So we played a game in Chuck Klein's hometown, Fort Wayne, Indiana. The Phillies had a scout at that time looking for 3 bases and a home plate, and wherever there was, we went on an off day and played somebody. You never got a day off or got a day's pay. So we're playing the General Electrics in Fort Wayne, and he's going to break in Hetzel that night. It's a night game. We're on our way to St. Louis. He plays short, goes in the hole. We get 2 or 3 double plays, and we're pretty enthusiastic. We go back to the Fort Wayne station, and we're standing in the bar, having a beer. The train was up on the tracks up above, waiting for the St. Louis Express to come through. Andy, Carl, and I, and somebody else, I don't know, Coker or somebody, and along comes Hetzel. So we said, Fitz said to be good to him, have a beer, Heine? Yeah, don't mind if I do. We gave him a beer, and he opens the aspirin box, and takes one of those beer aspirin boxes, and swoosh, down go the aspirins, and he drinks the beer, and we're looking at each other. What kind of an operation is this? Well, we got on the train, and I'm just falling off asleep, and somebody rattles my mattress. And it's Heine. And he says, you got any whiskey? And I had a little bottle in my bag, and Fitz says, be nice to him. So I said, my bag is in the men's room. Go ahead and help yourself. He had a couple of slugs of whiskey on top of that beer and aspirin. Now, remember, this guy's about 135 pounds. He comes out of the toilet, and he goes to Fitz's compartment, and he knocks on the door, and he says, get out of there, Fitz, you no good son of a bitch. I'm going to kill you right now. Fitz could have pinched his head off, one hand, easy. So Chuck Klein came out of the compartment. Fitz must have sent him out, and he took him like a sack of wheat and threw him in the upper berth, in his clothes. We get to St. Louis the next morning, and Fitz is yelling, where's that Hetzel? I'll get that son of a bitch. We go to the Chase Hotel, and Fitz can't find him. He sneaked into the bar already at 9 o'clock in the morning. So finally they corral him about noontime, and Fletcher, who I think was traveling secretary, took him and brought him to
Hagen.
No, Hagen was the secretary then. It was after Hagen.
Okay.
So he had taken sick or something, and he took him down to St. Louis Station and put him on the train to Indianapolis. But the secretary is telling me, he said, the only seat I could get for him was on the observation car. You know those old grills I used to have? He said, I got him a seat in the observation car and plunked him down, and he was glassy-eyed, and he saw those bars on the end of the train. He said, Christ, they got me back in the York jail again. And that was the end of Heine. But that's the kind of year we had.
You never think he'd do the job, and he just was a lush.
He was an aspirinator. Those are worse than the
aspirin
that
tastes alcohol.
Yeah, it must do something. It really drove him crazy.
What do you think of Freddie Fitzsimmons?
Greatest guy in the world. He was a wonderful guy, but he was a pitcher's manager. He's one of those guys that stays too long with a guy. You know, he figures himself when he pitched, I'll get out of the jam. And he'd always give that pitcher that extra out, and it would cost you. But he was a dandy guy. He was just a fine man to play for, you know. Never bothered you. Just rave once in a while, smash up a few bats and break a trunk or two. But quite a character, really.
How was Philadelphia's the baseball town at that time?
This was a very vicious place to play. That Shire Park always had a bunch of gamblers up in left field in that corner, and there was a big leather lung that sort of stayed in the second deck of fishmonger from somewhere. It was up over the first base side, and you could hear him all over the ballpark, and he'd wait till it's quiet, and he'd really give it to you. And it was a hard, vicious place to play baseball. There's no question about that. Those left field gamblers in Philly have always been tough to deal with. I don't know where they're hanging out now, but in the old ballpark, they were up in that corner in left field, right near the foul pole. And they were.
What did you think about Shy Park itself as a place to play?
All right.
The confines of the park.
I like the park.
Inside the line.
Yeah, I like the park. I thought they had a good groundskeeper there, and I enjoyed the park. I enjoyed Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. But
where did you live there?
2601 Parkway, across from the Art Museum. It was a brand new building then, and it was really dandy. Peacock and I, and Jittery Joe Berry, and Bobo Newsom, the four of us had an apartment. Those two were with the A's. So we'd move out, they'd move in, and we'd rent by the month and then just cut it down the middle and had a nice apartment, a nice place.
Jim Tobin threw a five-inning no-hitter at the Phillies that year up in Boston.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about that? It was June 22nd, 1944. Tobin, there were three no-hitters in the National League that year, and Tobin was the winning pitcher in two. He threw two of them himself, and the loser to Clyde Schoen and the other.
Well, I had an awful time with Jim. I went 0 for 28 for Jim in that year. And if I'd have hit, if he hadn't been in the league, I'd have hit 300. You take 28 times a bat on when you're hitting 281, you know, it would make quite a difference. And I never learned how to hit him until I got in the Coast League, and then it was too late. He pitched. He was with Seattle when I played for Hollywood.
He was a knuckleballer.
Yeah, he was a knuckleballer, but you had to dare him to throw the fastball. And once in a while, you could appeal to his vanity by getting way up in front of the box, and he'd say, "I'll show this guy I can throw the ball by him." And that's what, if he did that, then he's hurting himself. See? Once in a while, you could taunt him into doing this, and that's the only. And I didn't know that when I was. I was trying to hit him like any other human being, and I just had a fright with this man. That ball danced all over the place. He's a swell guy. Fine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, fine guy. Good hitter. Hit the ball well.
Mm-hmm. He had 3 home runs in 1 game.
I believe for Detroit or somebody.
Not for the Braves. Yeah.
Yeah, he hit the ball well. And